admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. So Ed, we invite you to share your experience with us.
They say that a pessimist looks at a glass and says it's half empty, and the optimist looks at a glass and says it's half full, and an alcoholic looks at the glass and says, are you going to finish that? And so we think cheerfulness and laughter can make for usefulness, but why shouldn't we laugh? We have recovered, and we have been given the power to help others. It's on page 132 of the big book. My name is Ed, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Ed.
And let me start off by telling you that I don't like doing this. I turn it over, but you know, it's something that I have to do. Like I said, that last line in from page 132 that I said, you know, we have recovered and have been given the power to help others. You know, what a tremendous, awesome statement that really is. You know. We a lot of meetings start and some finish with the Serenity Prayer, and my experience, and I'll tell you in just a bit, but I think of the original version of the Serenity Prayer. It's written by Reinhold Niebuhr, and it says, God, give me the grace to accept with serenity the things that cannot be changed, the courage to change the things that need to be changed, and the wisdom to know the difference from one to the other. And the reason that's important for me is because I'm the kind of person that can rationalize and come up with excuses and say that, well, you know, I know something needs to be changed, but I can't change it. You know, I don't have the power to do that. Instead of praying for the strength to do what really needs to be done. And that's a tough thing for me to do sometimes. They've asked me to speak tonight, this beginning of our journey for the next few weeks on the steps. This is not a lead, but I think it's important to for me to look back on the path that brought me to where I am today to start out on these steps, just to get a little bit of background. And again, I'm not going to give a lead by any means. I'll also tell you that because of some scheduling constraints, tonight I'm going to be talking about steps 1, 2, and 3. And I think as we go tonight, you'll see how they tie in with my experience. I am here to share my experience, strength, and hope with these steps. I'm here to share my experience, not my opinions. I'm here to share my strengths, not my advice. And I'm here to share my hopes, and not my fears. You know, if I start giving, and believe me, I'm no saint. So if I cross that line, I'll try and admit it. And if you catch me on it, point it out. You know, if I share my opinions instead of my experience, I tend to get in trouble because I start taking it back. You know, I have an awful lot invested in my own opinions on things. And I know, you know, people go to war over opinions. You know, I've gotten arguments, heated arguments, and today I try not to do that, especially when it comes to my recovery. As far as sharing my strength instead of my advice, I learned a long time ago that wise people don't need it, and fools aren't going to heed it anyway. So I'm really careful with that. And if I start sharing my fears instead of my hopes, that takes me right back to those 100 forms of fears and that guilt and that shame, and it takes me right back to that loss of faith that I have in this program and in my higher power. So, with that said, let me give you some advice. I'll tell you, do not do what I've done. And I'll tell you about that very quickly here. I've done some things in recovery, especially early on, that maybe could have been done better. They were done the way they were done, and I can't change that. I had issues with trusting people. I couldn't trust myself. I did a lot of nasty things to people. You know, they say we will not regret the past, but there are times when I still cringe at some of the things I've done. Today, I try and view them as a real lesson to move forward and to see if I can help anyone else get through similar things. So I couldn't trust myself. When I was younger, I was sexually abused by a priest I really admired, and that shot that right out the window, along with any kind of faith or religion or spirituality that I had. I will talk about that, you know, as we get into steps 2 and 3 a little bit. Because of my trust issues, you know, in the book, Working with Others and Into Action, there's a guideline. It's a great guideline for how you work with others and bring them along through these steps and introduce them into recovery. And that, to me, is the basis. So it shows to me the importance of sponsorship. You know, I couldn't trust myself. I couldn't trust other people. I was a result of some rumors and some gossip early on in the program, which that's a whole nother story, maybe for my lead, but. It took me, and this is where I say, don't do what I've done. It took me 11 years to ask somebody to be my sponsor. Now, I admitted I was powerless over alcohol. I thought I did all the steps. I ended up in a rehab at the care unit. My sobriety date is Labor Day, September 3rd, 1983. And I'll tell you, before I forget, my home group is the Silk Road Group in Ripley, New York. We are on Zoom right now. We're reading from Language of the Heart. You can find all our meetings on nypeninnergroup.org. That's N-Y-P-E-N-N, innergroup.org. And the Silk Road Group, we named it because we have people off and on that come from Fredonia, Dunkirk, Casadega, Westfield, Mayville, Lakewood, Northeast, Ripley, Westfield, Wesleyville, Harbor Creek, Erie. So that's where that name came from. And that Silk Road Group, I will tell you, is the best AA meeting in Western New York, if not the entire state. And if your AA group, home group, is not the best AA home group there is, maybe, again, I'm crossing a line and giving you some advice like my sponsor gave me, do something about it. So I'll leave all that go. you know, when I drank, I admitted long before I got here that I was powerless over alcohol. I just couldn't admit that my life was unmanageable. I was the kind of person, I was fairly intelligent, did well in school, generally could get myself out of a jam if I got into one, and I spent so much energy not getting into jams in the first place. I never got a demerit in school, never had detention, but I made some bad choices. You know, I got good grades in school. I had academic scholarships to some great universities, and I chose to decide, I don't know what I want to do with my life, so I'm just going to play it by ear. Well, I never went to college. Well, I did, but never finished. Started drinking right off the bat. I got a job in a shop, and I fell into it with a bunch of guys that drank hard and heavy, and I was off to the races. So all that hurt that was done to me and all that hurt that I'd done to other people, just it was fuel on the fire. And I just kept going and going and going. People would talk to me about my drinking, and I would say, yeah, you know, it's a dirty job, but somebody's got to do it. And that was that admitting part, you know, that I really was powerless over alcohol. And I knew it, you know, but I didn't care. I got to the point where I just didn't care anymore. There were times where I would drink so much and would be so sick that I would swear with every fiber of my being that I was never, ever going to drink again. You know, when I'm down on my knees, puking into a nasty toilet and laying my face up against the side of this nasty toilet because it felt nice and cool and comforting. I mean, that's where I was, you know. I swear I'd never drink again. And 3 or 4 days later, I was already drunk. I wasn't the type of person that thought about that first drink. I went right from I'm never ever going to drink again to, hey, that 3 or 4 in me already. Oh well, too bad, keep going. And off again to the races. when I ended up in the rehab, there were three times in my life that I can remember that I wept. One was something that I really nasty that I did to a person who, thank God, I was able to make amends to her. The second was when my nephew, who was very close to me, killed himself. And the third was when they dragged me into a rehab. When I got into that rehab, I was out of options. I was the kind of guy that could figure everything out, and nothing was working anymore. But I didn't know that top of mind. It was just all automatic for me. I say my drinking was instinctive and reflexive as an alcoholic. You go to the doctor, you cross your legs, he taps your knee and your foot moves, put me in a bar, set a drink in front of me, and my elbow bent. You know, I just, that's how it was, and I never thought about it. I ran out of every single option that I had. If it wasn't a union shop, I know I would have lost my job. If it wasn't for my mother, I know I would have been on the street. It got to the point where that last night, and you know, they say, I'm glad I remember that last night still very well to this day, even though I was a blackout drinker. I don't ever want to forget that. But thankfully, people intervened and got me into a rehab. And that's where I was introduced to the 12 steps. And again, here's some advice. Don't do what I did. I did all 12 steps within those 28 days. Didn't know anything about anything. Thank God the staff there did not mail those letters that I wrote, you know, to make amends to people, because I don't know what kind of can of worms that would have opened up. But about on the fourth day in the rehab, I just start crashing real bad, you know, going into DTs. And afterwards, working with counselors, and they said, you know, this, it started to make sense, because all those times I swore I was never going to drink again, I could go about 3 or 4 days and then I'd be drunk. And that was my body's natural instinct to take that drink to ward off those DTs, and I never even thought about it. So that started to make sense. So, did all 12 steps in a rehab, out, and but you know, when they took me in there, I took the second half of that first step, you know. I finally realized that I'm powerless over my life. Like I said, I was the type of person that could figure anything out. Just ask me, you know. And it wasn't working anymore. That last night, I knew that I was not going to live to see the morning. I was never the type of person to contemplate killing myself, but I just knew inside me that I wasn't going to see the morning. And again, thankfully, there were people that intervened. you know, when I finally asked 11 years later someone to be my sponsor, and that was getting over the trust issues, humility, all those things were in my way. They taught me a lesson. Would I have it any other way today? No. I can't say that for you. You need to follow your own path. That was my path. That's what got me where I ended up. I finally asked someone to be my sponsor because I knew I couldn't do it alone anymore. You know, being on the wrong end of some gossip and some nasty rumors going around in this program, you know, I figured, so much, you know, for that trust issue is even worse. So I figured, well, God's going to be my sponsor. Trouble is, God never answers a phone. So I finally realized that I had to ask someone, and I couldn't do it myself. And I asked this person to be my sponsor, and he said, Ed, I can't do it. He said, no. But I took that step, you know. I took that step. Met a fellow out in my home group, another home group I was at. He was kind of bouncing back and forth between here and Florida. And he had, about 27, 28 years at the time. And finally, had a lot of respect for this man, and finally asked him to be my sponsor. And he didn't say no, but he didn't say yes. He says, let's meet for coffee. We met for coffee, and he says, if you really want this program, I'll go to the wall for you. He says, if you don't, we're done. And that's how he was with me. Next thing he asked me was, did you do the steps? And I says, yeah, I did the steps. And he says, you screwed him up, so we're going to start all over again. And that's what he did. And we did that by the book, by the big book. At breakfast, he says, you have a big book? And I says, yeah, I do. And at that time, they gave us a big book in the rehab. It was a third edition. And at that point, when I asked my sponsor to be my sponsor, this book was like mint condition, pristine, you know. They say, that old saying you might have heard, you want to hide something from an alcoholic, put it in his big book. Well, that was me. So he said, well, you got a big book, I want you to read chapter 3. Okay, go to a meeting. He says, did you read it? I says, yeah. He says, good, read it again. We'll talk next week. He wasn't the kind, says, call me every day. Read it again, go to a meeting. He says, did you read chapter 3 again? I says, yeah, I did. He says, good, read it again. He made me read it 3 times. Because the thing he was trying to drill into my head was that there is no effective mental defense against that first drink. Because he had seen me at meetings and heard me talk and seen me do my thing long enough to know that left to my own devices, I'm going to figure this out. And he had to knock that down, and he had to beat that out of me. And then we started working the steps. They say that step 1 is the first 100% step. And like I said, when they brought me into rehab, and like I said, I remember 3 times in my life that I wept, and that was one of them. I knew that I was done. Now, step 2, came to believe that power,
right?
Yeah, greater than myself could restore me to sanity. My upbringing in religion was, didn't do anything for me. You know, that God was distant, he was vengeful, he was punishing, I couldn't relate to this at all. I was forced into doing a lot of stuff that I didn't, nothing was in here with it. I learned over the years that especially my parents, my mother especially, I used to joke early on in my rebellious days that if you look up the word religious fanatic in the dictionary, you'll see my parents' picture in there. But, I've come over the years to learn to respect that and what it did for them. And if their faith was genuine and deep, and I hope that I'm on the path to gaining some genuine and deep faith in a power that's greater than myself that I can understand. So, I came to believe that, and it wasn't that hard for me once it was explained to me. My sponsor, because I always knew there was something there, but it was just never, no one helped me, gave me what I needed to work through it. And my sponsor, Bill, was there for me with that. And one of the things that he said that really impressed me, that sticks to me with this day, is you are a spiritual being having a human experience. And that connected me, it made me realize that I really am a part of the divine. I've heard it years prior in the program, God doesn't make junk. For all those times I hated myself, couldn't trust myself. But, today, I love myself. I really do. Am I perfect? By no means. The other thing too about that is, like when he said, you're a spiritual being having a human experience, that opened so many doors for me to go down, and it was okay to go down now. Before it was almost like forbidden to go there because that's not what we believe. I would go to a lot. I went to a lot of meetings, and I talked about serenity prayer briefly, and a lot of meetings closed with the Lord's Prayer. My home group we closed with the responsibility statement, but that's another matter. I've been to some meetings where there are people of other spiritual and religious persuasions that aren't Christian, and I've seen them get angry at that, and I'll talk about that later on, at 10 and 11 when we get there. But, and again, this is my journey. I might say something over the course of the next few weeks that you don't agree with, that might upset you. You want to turn me off of Zoom and go do something else? Fine. If you want to walk out of the meeting, fine. This is my journey. This is my experience. This, I have to be true to myself. When we say the Lord's Prayer, I grew up with that. And I could do that. Join a circle, hold hands, say the prayer. And after a while, it became empty. And again, I'm not criticizing anyone that does that, believes that for any reason at all. Like I said, over time, I really learned to understand and respect the faith that my parents had and my family had. Very briefly, because this ties into this power greater than myself, a God of my own understanding. The Lord's Prayer for me starts out really good. You know, it says, "Our." And after that, you kind of lose me, you know? Because I believe that I'm a spiritual being having a human experience as well as everybody else here, you know? My prayer is, "Oh my God, you are here. Oh my God, I am here. Oh my God, we are here." After that, it goes to Father, which speaks of that paternalistic, you know, kind of thing. And it reminds me of the holy cards we got when we were kids with, you know, God in a big purple robe and a brilliant halo and a gold staff sitting in a throne. And the only thing that you couldn't see in that picture of the holy card was that little button that hit the trap door when you got in front of him and you pissed him off and he hit it and you went straight to hell, you know? Anyway, who art in heaven? That tells me that God is out there, you know? Today I believe that God is in here. When I can start to tap into that, I know that it's in each and every other person. Hard for me to do, especially coming here in traffic again, you know? And we'll talk a little more about this later, you know, maintaining our conscious contact. But God is here, you know? And I am here. And you are here. And we are here. And that's really powerful for me. So, step three, you know, talking about, real briefly before I forget, my sponsor, when he had me read chapter three, because he wanted to drill that into my head, you know, that there is no effective mental defense against that first drink, because he knew that that was that's how I am. He always told me that my mind is behind enemy lines. And, you know, he gave me a poster that said, "Think, think, think." And I said, "Bill, what the heck is this? You tell me my mind's behind enemy lines, and yet you give me a poster that says, think, think, think." And he worked with me through that. There's a right way to do it, and to get out of my own way and to turn it over and to realize and be aware, you know. he told me for the longest time, when I would come up with some things, he'd say, "Ed, stay out of the deep end of the pool," you know. And it made sense to me. Like I said, I may say some things that upset you or you don't agree with, and that's fine. There was one time my sponsor, I had to tell my mother something, and I knew it was going to break her heart, and to the point where I was afraid of a big rift in the family. And my sponsor told me, he says, "Is it true?" I says, "Yeah, it's the truth." And he says, "You know you need to tell her." I says, "I know I need to tell her." And he says, "You have no idea what God has on her plate." He says, "If she shuts you out, she shuts you out. You've done what you had to do. But from that point on, you do the things a good son does. Mother's Day, you send her a card. Christmas, you go over. You know, her birthday, you send her flowers. If she slams the door and throws the flowers in the trash, you keep on doing that because those are the things that a good son does." And he taught me to take that and take that into work. Take that into the community. Do the things that a good employee does. Do the things that a good person on the block does. So I've said some things that really ring true with me, and I'm not saying they should ring true for you. This is my story. Follow your own path. And if I upset you enough to leave, you know, I have no idea what God has on your plate either. But it reminds me of page 184 in the big book where it says there's nothing that'll keep a man in ignorance. I can't quote it so much as contempt prior to investigation. So that was kind of the think that my sponsor was talking about. Step three, made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood Him. There's a story in the back of the big book. It's called Vicious Cycle. And that will give you a little feedback or a little background onto where that phrase came. God as we understand Him. Because this person that wrote that story, again, it's a vicious cycle. It's in both the third and the fourth editions, I believe. he had a hard time with the God thing, you know, for a long time. And he was one of the first ones, the first group to get sober. And very near the end of his story, you know, when they were trying to formulate all this and put it into on paper and into and publish it in the big book, he spoke up and he was very adamant that you include the words God as we understand him, you know. And what freedom that gave me, you know. I will afford that freedom to you just as well. And I'm going to talk a lot more about that later on in the steps. So, made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as we understood him. Morally, ethically, spiritually, physically, bankrupt. Got me here. Didn't I ran out of options. Didn't have any other choices. I knew I couldn't do this by myself anymore. This program opened that door to a power greater than myself, which is opposite of that willpower, that energy that I would put into figuring it out. It was finally letting go of that mistrust and putting it into something that I could believe in that could help me through this. I didn't have much of a problem with that at all. Really, I didn't. My concept of God is so completely different than what I was brought up with. And it only naturally followed that, yes, I'll make a decision to do this. And what helped me very early on was, that doesn't mean I flick a switch and I'm 100% better. That's what the rest of the steps are for, you know? Change in me. They say, stop drinking and change everything in your life. That's what this program of recovery is about. And we'll talk more about that starting next week when we go into step four and onward. But, you know, that it was a natural progression for me to make that decision. And I heard someone say in a lead, you know, when I made that decision, he says, it was just like I didn't. Again, it didn't make everything change overnight. It was just a decision to do that. It's like, and this fellow in this lead, he says, if I want to go to California, I'm okay, on vacation, this is where I'm going to go. That was my decision. Making a decision to go to California. Now comes the work. Am I going to fly? Am I going to drive? Do I have to take time off of work? Am I going to go alone? Where am I going to get all the money from? All that is in the other steps. That made it so much easier for me to be at peace with that turning it over. I knew that there was some freedom, some leeway, some give there, because, you know, in the big book it says, we are not saints, we're talking about progress rather than perfection. And, you know, turning it over, realizing that I had absolutely nothing left. that God, who I found to be loving, accepting, patient, forgiving. Sometimes I wonder, I have bad days, but on a daily basis I go back to that. We'll talk about that more in the other step. So, step one, two, and three for me, in a nutshell, that was it, and I'm going to stop right there.
Thank you, Ed. So now we have time for questions and answers. Anybody here in the room, go ahead and raise your hand and we'll get you the microphone. And if you're on Zoom, just go ahead and speak up whenever you have the opportunity. So who would like to get us started?
Hi, I'm Patrick. I'm an alcoholic. Thanks, Ed. I think, and if I'm taking liberty with what you said, I apologize, but you seem to have suggested that your early experience with organized religion sort of alienated you in some way. But do you think that, nevertheless, that grounding in organized religion was helpful in you forming your version of your higher power later on?
Zoom, did you hear that? He says that that background I had in that organized religion early on that kind of turned me off, could you say? Did that help provide me a basis or a foundation for what I believe in now? Is that a good way to paraphrase that?
Right.
Yeah, it did, you know. When I got out of high school, I got a job in a shop, and there was a carpenter there, and they needed a bench built, you know. This guy, most senior carpenter, it was a union shop, most senior guy in the whole plant, he came up and he threw this thing together. I mean, a monkey probably could have done it half better, you know. And I looked at that. No one was going to say anything. They couldn't do anything to him. He had seniority. And I went, got a big piece of cardboard, and I wrote on there with a big fat magic marker, how to not build a bench, and I stuck it on there. So, in that regard, yeah, that religion, how not to force myself to try and believe something that I don't believe in, you know, how not to do this. So, in that regard, yeah, that really helped me, because it showed me that doesn't work for me, it's not going to work for me. That, boy, you know, I can't wrap my head around God, you know? I just can't. It's like, you ever see those jars with the colored sand and really fancy, you know, the sand in them? It's like I could pick out a grain of sand in there, you know? That's about all I know of God, you know? I can take that jar and take it to the beach, you know, and throw it on the beach and pick up one grain of sand. And that's how much I know about God. I can look at all the beaches in the world and all the sand there is, and I can pick up one grain of sand, and that's about as much as I know about God. But I have faith, you know, that I know that everything's going to be okay. You know, I've always gotten everything I ever needed. That religious training that I had growing up was, you screw up, you're in trouble big time, you know. Now it's, my higher power says, everything I put in your life is a blessing. Everything I put in your life, there's a lesson there. Every person I put in your life is an angel. Now, I can pick out the bad things, or what I think are the bad things, or I can look for the lesson. Like I said earlier on when I was speaking, there's a lot of things I did. You know, they say we will not regret the past, but there are a lot of things I did when I was drinking and out there that, boy, it's a cringe, still cringe at today. Have I learned anything from them? I hope so. You know, can I help other people that have gone through similar things? I've had people tell me that I have. Would I have it another way? Yeah, you know, but that's not what I pray for. That's not what this program tells me to do. It says God's will, not my will. So, if that answers that.
It does. Thanks, Ed. Who else would like to ask a question?
Thanks, Ed. Nice work. I really appreciate what you've shared with us tonight. I think you said...
A little feedback.
I think you said that you were about 11 years in before you had asked for a sponsor. Did one thing in particular trigger that? What, or were you just to that point? You had nowhere else, sort of like coming to AA, you had nowhere else to go.
He's asking that when I said, you know, it took me 11 years to finally ask someone to be my sponsor, was there a trigger for that? Or was there something that... got me to that point, or was it just that I had nowhere else to go? Like I said, I was on the receiving end of some pretty nasty gossip at one point. You know, somebody in the program had threatened to kill me. He probably wouldn't have killed me, but he was bigger than I was, and he probably would have done a number on me. You know, and it was like, you know, screw this to the whole program. You know, because I took a character defect that I myself have and denied it, put it into somebody else, said that's not right, expanded that into the whole of AA program, and said, screw this, I'm not going back to AA. And I didn't go back for a long time, many, many months that I didn't go to a meeting. Talk about white knuckling it. I didn't drink, thank God. I knew I couldn't drink, you know. That obsession to drink really was lifted, and I'm grateful for that. But I knew... my life was just shallow, you know. I had a sense that there was a much... My sponsor told me to stay out of the deep end of the pool, but I knew there was a very deep well there that I was entitled to, that each one of us is entitled to. And I couldn't do this by myself because I've seen so many people in the program testify to that. And it finally got through my head, you know. Again, my sponsor, read chapter 3. You can't figure this out by yourself, Ed. So.
Anybody on Zoom have a question?
Anybody on Zoom have a question? Nope.
Or here in the room.
They're not sleeping, so that's a good sign.
Hi, Ed. Thanks very much for coming out tonight. I appreciate it. My question was, you said that your sponsor gave you that think sign. Could you explain a little bit of what he said to you about that and how that turned out?
He's asking when my sponsor gave me that sign that said think. Actually, it was a poster that had a lot of sayings on it, but think was prominent. I mean, you could read in the background, you know, first things first and easy does it, but do it and all that stuff. At that point, my sponsor was moving to Florida, and he didn't want to take, you know, anything he didn't have to. So he says, would you like to have this poster? And I said, sure, I'll take that poster. So that's how I ended up with it. Like I said, when it was like, you're giving me this poster that says think, but you're telling me not to think. And it's kind of tough, I guess, for me to put into words. Basically, it comes down to, I think there's a part in the book where it says, God gave us a brain to use. And I guess it's the proper use of that, the proper use of the will, the proper use of my mental functioning that will help me further down the path. It's when I start taking that back and figuring that I can do this all by myself. You know, what do you know? You know, screw all you, like I said before. So that's basically, I think, what he was saying. You know, it's the proper use of that. And he worked with me a long time to make sure that he kind of... busted that bronco in me, because that was, he says, it's my default position, you know. Left to my own devices, I tend to slip back to that, you know. Figure it out. Stuff breaks at home, you know. Figure it out. Mary says, why don't we just get a new one? I said, I can figure this out. I can fix this, you know. And then I fix the snowblower, and she says, wow, I'm impressed. And my head goes, woo, you know. But I can't do that with my soul. I can't do that with my program. You know, God's given me talents. He's given you talents. For me to put those on a shelf and just say, you know, to be so humble, that's not the right use of it either. So,
any other questions? Too early.
One more follow-up.
When you were talking about the third step and coming to you know, an understanding of the God that you understood, and with your background and all that, in taking 11 years to get to that step, pretty much with another person the way the program suggests, what was that internal conflict with you like, as far as, I'm sure it was more of a process than a switch going on, but if you could walk us through that process of going from a negative experience to a positive experience where that you could rely on and build the foundation of your future program.
He's asking what was kind of the process that got me 11 years into finally asking somebody to be my sponsor. These trust issues, you know, I didn't like myself. I couldn't trust myself. I knew I did a lot of bad things to a lot of people. Constantly growing up, I heard things like, what's the matter with you, you know? Boy, you screwed up again, you know? Why can't you just? When I start after that issue with the gossip and the rumors and stuff, and I let that go, and gained a little bit of forgiveness. There's a saying in the program that says stick with the winners, you know. And I get what they're trying to say. I don't want to infer that there are losers in the program, because I really don't believe that there are. But there are some people that, man, if you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. And, boy, my sponsor, Bill, I don't know the guy's names, but if you ever saw the Muppets, those two old guys that sat up in the balcony and just can complain all the time, he was the one on the left, you know? A couple people on Zoom knew who he was. But for all his gruffness and for all his, you know, he showed me over time, before I asked him to be my sponsor, when I saw him in meetings, he was trustworthiness in action, you know? He was compassion in action. He could have a smart mouth, but I got his sense of humor, you know? So it was paying attention. It was, I want what you have. You know, early on, because again, these trust issues and things, there were people that really helped me, you know. They were like pseudo-sponsors, you know. I was a type of person, if I wanted some feedback, if I wanted some help, smart enough to watch people to know who was going to give me the answer that I wanted to hear on a certain, whatever the issue was that I was dealing with. So I'd go to that person and I'd say, what do you think about this? And they, you know, and I would almost ask like leading questions to get the answer that I wanted. I knew who the people were that wouldn't put up with that. And man, I stiff-armed them for a long, long, long time. So what got me to that point of finally, you know, letting that go? I knew I was powerless over alcohol, that I couldn't drink anymore, that my life was unmanageable. And I started to get a glimpse over time. Part of it was coming back to meetings. I had a lot of good friends in this program, too, that helped me. So a lot of it was just, you know, suiting up and showing up, in spite of myself, for the many times that I didn't even want to do that. So stick with the winners, you know. It's like, I really admire what this person not just has to say, but what this person is, you know. And I wouldn't even say what this person does, you know, because my sponsor Bill told me one time, he says, when I would get carried away, he says, Ed, you're turning into a human doing, not a human being. And that made a lot of sense to me, you know. So it's who I am. And it's like that real thirst and that hunger for, I really do want to do better, you know? I hated the things I did to some people. I hated the things I did to myself. And I really wanted to do better. And finally, I just had to give up. You know? So that's how I got there. If that makes any sense.
Any other questions for Ed?
We got a Zoom question.
It's either you or me.
Terry,
we got a Zoom question.
Okay, go ahead.
Terry's asking, how do I deal with somebody that I'm working with that is a tried and true atheist? How do I get them to believe in something, you know, a higher power? There's this guy I know out in my neighborhood. I've known him for 25 years. And he's strung together at the most 5 years of sobriety. He's what I call a serial sobrietist, you know? 5 years and he was out. Then he'd get a few months and he was out. And then he'd get a year and a half and he was out. Now he's settled down into a pattern of 3 months, 4 months, then he's out. And he's going to crash and burn big time. And I've tried to work with him, you know. He goes to church with his parents and he tries to force it, you know. That wasn't going to work for me, like I said when I was talking. He's trying to make that happen. I'm trying to tell him that that doesn't have to be that way. If you really don't believe it, and he finds, you know, there were times, twice I remember when he says, you know, I really don't believe in God. So he admits it, you know. I've given him some readings that are more spiritual in nature than they are religious in nature. And man, I could talk for a couple hours about that stuff. But I try and talk about, first of all, especially in recovery, in the program, the kinship that we have, you know. Marty Mann, when she was getting sober, she said, you know, these people, they get me, you know. They can finish my sentences. I can finish their sentences. They understand me. And I said, Rob, when you go to meetings, you know, pay attention to the people that get you, you know. Yeah, he picks up on all the things that he doesn't like. And I say, but what are the things that you can be grateful for? What kind of lesson can you learn from that? And that mechanism, that dynamic, is a power greater than any one person. You know, it can be a power, an energy between two people. You know, when any two alcoholics meet, you know, there's an AA meeting. That's a power greater than just you and just me. So, baby steps, I guess. And I've tried that, and he's drunk right now. So I pray for him, you know. We had a question in the back.
Yeah, thank you. I think you kind of answered it, but I'll try one more time. And by the way, great job, Ed. Thank you so much for sharing. I'm newer to AA, a couple months in. I come from a long line of alcoholics. My father was an alcoholic who found AA and, to my knowledge, spent the next 40 years sober without a drink. And I, as I grew up, I didn't know that much about it other than that's where my dad goes and he was drinking and now he isn't and that must be how it works. You go there and you stop drinking. And the tradition number three says the only requirement is the desire to stop. Not necessarily stopping, as odd as that sounds. You mentioned your friend. And I think beyond the desire, I think every one of us would love to be the person who did a 180 and never again walked into that space. But I'm trying to understand how that works within the walls of AA. Like your friend you mentioned, would that person be in the program, then out of the program, then in the program, then out of the program? Or is it, we also say, none of us are saints. We do not expect perfection. What does that mean? That like we're all human and we slip up from time to time, but does that slip up kind of put us out and then we're back? I'm curious, maybe just in, if nothing else, your opinion on that.
He asked for my opinion. I said I wasn't going to give any, but so. And let me see if I can paraphrase this. He's asking, comes from a long line of alcoholics in his family, people, you know, sober for 4 years or whatever and go back out. And that tradition three says the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. So where does that leave someone like the friend that I'm talking about, who's the serial sobrietist, you know? I believe that, you know, like I mentioned, you know, at our home group, we're reading out of Language of the Heart. And we just finished a part, one of the letters that Bill W. wrote. You know, early on in AA, if you slipped more than once, you were blackballed from AA. You know, you couldn't even come back in. Bill Wells, you know, it reminds me of a story. I was, you know, like I said, when I got here, when they dragged me into a rehab, and I finally realized that I was done. But remember all those times I swore that I would never drink again and was drunk before I knew it? I was at a meeting one time, and this girl, she reintroduced again. And she was one of those that would get 3 months, 4 months, almost a year, 3 months. And she was sitting right across the table from me at this meeting, and she reintroduced again. And it finally hit me, you know. Honestly, up until that point, people that would, you know, bounce in and out, reintroduce, it was like, I didn't know why they couldn't get it. Part of my ego says, well, I got it. But when she did it that time, it hit me that I relapsed 1,000 times. I just did it before I got to the program, you know. And I told her that after the meeting. And man, she almost broke down. She says, thank you. She says, I thought you were judging me. I hated to reintroduce because I thought you were going to judge me. And I says, I never really did judge you. But I thank you for the lesson you taught me, that I'm really no better. You know, I'm no saint. the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. I know 3 people off the top of my head that I can tell you that introduce themselves when they're at a meeting, when they'll come up and do read the steps or whatever. My name is so-and-so, and I have a desire to stop drinking. You know, for whatever it is, they can't say I'm an alcoholic. Do we kick them out? No. My friend, he did something this last time that really ticked me off, and that's a matter of, and I won't go into the details, but he kind of crossed the line. Am I going to shut him out? No. When anyone anywhere reaches out for help, I want the hand of AA to be there. If I was to say, well, you did this and that was over the line, you're done. Who am I to judge? You know? For all those times that I screwed up and all the things that I did, if somebody did that to me, I wouldn't be here right now. I know I'd be dead. So, yeah, who am I to judge? And if he comes back and decides he wants it, you know, I'll try and do what I can do. And if he doesn't get it, guess what? It helps me stay sober. And that reminds me, so many times I've heard people early on, especially when they're new and working with their sponsor and going on 12 steps calls or working with new people, and then that person that they're working with relapses and they say, gee whiz, what did we do wrong? You know, this person got drunk. And they say, we didn't do anything wrong. Did you drink? No. Then you're 100% successful. Sounds kind of cold, but that's the truth, you know. And boy, unfortunately, some of us have to die so that the rest of us can live. And that's a hard truth. What's the lesson in that? You know, I meditate on that. I pray on that. And I have to really believe that that's God's will, and it's more than I can know right at this point in time. So I just can't. I have a hard time shutting somebody out because they screwed up, because then that is, they screwed up according to my terms, my opinions, you know, of what I think should be. So, if that answers that.
Thanks, Ed.
We're over.
So we invite you back next week. Ed, is it going to be just step 4 or?
Four and five.
Steps 4 and 5 next week.